Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you on Wednesday evening, August 18th, 2010. It is now 7.01 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. You can send us your email anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. I also encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website. That's going to be our guest this evening, by the way, to sutton-associates.net in his newsletter. Andy discusses economic issues and how they affect you. In fact, Andy is on the line now, I believe. Let's get him on the line and let's get the show going. Good evening. Is that you, Andy?
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Fine. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well.
You've been busy, I bet, lately.
I've been very busy. It's nice to take a break and chat with you.
Okay, good. Consider this a respite from everything that's been going on. Well, last month we had you on the program. We intend to hopefully have you, if you'd like, on the third Wednesday of every month from now until maybe the year. I think what our contract runs out about 2042, right, Andy? Somewhere around there.
Yeah, something like that. I know you mentioned, possibly exhuming a body or something like your email.
Folks, I have to tell
you. I look forward to being on here, so that's good.
Yeah, I have to tell everyone what you meant by that. I sent Andy an email, and I enjoy his newsletters because they're so insightful. And they're easy to understand, and they're not gobbledygook hype. I mean, they're just raw numbers and it's straight talk. And I sent an email to Andy saying that, you know, this is a warning. If you would die, I'm going to exhume your body so you can continue your monthly newsletter. Then we'll put you back in the ground. Well, I hope you took that as a compliment, and nothing else.
I did. I figured, well, there's two ways I can look at this, so I'm going to take it the good way.
Okay. Well, Andy, I think I'd like to start. There's a lot of things I'd like to talk about because I read your newsletter in Find the Tale, and I always do. I print the whole thing out, and I go to the coffee shop, and I sit there in my little corner, and I read the whole thing. Since last month, when we last discussed economic issues, has anything progressed? Can we say we are better off now than we were before in any areas? And what areas have we regressed? If you could just comment on that, please.
Well, that's a good question. I can tell you that as far as progressing, consumers did deleverage a little bit further in the most recent month. The consumer credit numbers did contract slightly. Credit card use, outstanding balances, I should say, was down significantly. So that's a good thing. People continue to deleverage. Of course, when you listen to the mainstream press, you see this is a double-edged sword that we have. When consumers don't borrow and spend, that's viewed as bad for the economy because right. So much of the economy relies on consumption. Right. And it's been fueled by debt for so many decades now that the mainstream press, when consumer credit numbers go down or retail sales are flat or any of those kind of measures, everybody, it's like you're at a funeral, to bring back the prior analogy there. So that was a good thing as far as moving forward, but it's a double-edged sword because if consumers aren't borrowing and spending, GDP is going to be sluggish. I mean, we could get a revision downward on second quarter GDP. It could be close to flat growth. I mean, it could be well within the margin of error for what the measurement is. I mean, they were talking about 2%, and now they're talking, well, maybe it was only, you know, 0.4 because of the trade imbalance or trade deficit swelled. So that's not good. And that's in the face of the dollar becoming weaker. So that's usually export friendly, but our exports were down significantly last month. So, you know, the consumer credit is good. That was nice to see. But some of these other measures, the jobs numbers are still not, there's nothing there. I mean, there's been a lot of money spent, well over $1 trillion just in direct stimulus, and it's not really having much of a benefit on jobs outside of the census. And I don't even really count that because it's make work. It doesn't produce anything.
Right.
What does it produce?
Right.
You know, the census doesn't, it doesn't pay for itself. So I really don't even give that too much credibility. I mean, it paid some people's mortgages for a couple of months, and it bought some groceries and that kind of thing, but it's not sustainable. And it seems that's where we're at, Joe. Now, you've got a situation where most of Washington just seems to say, well, we'll just keep stimulating. And every time the economy slows, we'll just borrow another trillion or $2 trillion, and we'll stimulate. We'll fix more roads and bridges. We'll take another census. Maybe we'll do the census every year.
Right.
You know, that seems to be where we're at. So philosophically, there's been no progress. They still haven't figured out that the government can't be all things to all people, the government can't create jobs, and the government cannot create economic prosperity. So, I mean, as far as the mindset goes, unfortunately, we're really no different than we were a month ago.
Yeah. Folks, just let me remind you, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. With us this evening, we have Andy Sutton, Chief Strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We're going to be talking about the economic conditions as they exist right now, and maybe can square us away as to where we need to go to protect ourselves. Andy, there's something I don't understand. The government spending is included in the GDP, which to me is an oxymoron in itself. But the government spends money, let's say gives it to someone. That person then takes the money and spends it. Now they include that spending in the GDP. Do we not have a double dipping and a false double dipping, or am I looking at this incorrectly?
No, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You know, and I've written about this a number of times, and it's a real issue. Every time we get the quarterly GDP reading, you know, they'll say, oh, well, you know, gross domestic product was up 2.4% annualized based on last quarter's results. And they always report, Joe, an annualized number, and that is what is important also. So if you're looking at a 2.4% annualized pace, that means that they expected the quarter to be 0.6%. So you've got to keep that in mind also.
Right.
So on some of these measurements, they always report annualized figures because it makes it look bigger.
Yeah.
And I really believe that that's an intentional bias that's built into the methodology, but it even goes, Joe, a step further than what you said. Not only do they report government spending, now some government spending is legitimate, but what they also do is every dollar that the government borrows from a third party, from China or from OPEC nations or wherever, they borrow it, they spend it in the economy, that gets counted as if it was, you know, some, you know, from some surplus account that the government had. You know, say the government had a little, you know, for lack of a better term, a little fiscal cookie jar, and there was actually real savings in there.
Right.
They count a borrowed dollar spent in the economy the same as they would count a saved dollar spent in the economy, and that's totally fraudulent.
Right, right. Okay. I thought maybe I was just losing it because we always key on spending, and spending is not really the indicator of the health of an economy. That's the result of producing something, of being productive. We're not being we are productive in what we do, but not as much as we used to, but yet we expect the spending to outpace our productivity, and thus equals growth. And it shakes me up. I just can't get a handle on that, and no one seems to want to address that, at least in the mainstream media. Am I thinking incorrectly?
Well, no, I mean, you're right. The productivity versus spending, that whole paradigm is kind of like a rodent or a gerbil on one of those little wheels that you put them on in the cage, where the gerbil has to run faster and faster and faster to prevent itself from falling off the little wheel. That's kind of what we have with regards to productivity. You know, every time the productivity numbers come out, they always say, oh, know, the American worker is so much more productive and they're doing so much more for less. Well, yeah, that's because people are doing a lot of extra work for free because they don't want to lose jobs. I mean, it's not true in every case, but it's certainly true in a lot of cases. So, and it really underscores the point that I try to drive home in both the 2 cents newsletter and the paid subscription letter as well, is you really have to look at the methodologies and the institutional inherent biases of these reporting metrics, whether it's unemployment, retail sales, inflation, as measured by CPI, whatever the situation is, you really have to tear down the methodology and figure out what they're actually reporting or what they're not reporting, and then you get kind of get a better idea of what is going on there. And they don't talk about that in mainstream. But the productivity and savings thing, yes, that's another broken, I guess you'd call it an ideology of sorts, where, you know, mainstream government economists, they think that all you have to do is keep people spending faster than productivity or, you know, that sort of thing, and then all of a sudden that's going to generate growth. And they're coming about it totally the wrong way.
Right. We have a couple people on the line. Let's see if this person has a question for you or a comment. 378, hello. Good evening. Thank you for calling in. Your name, please.
Hi, my name is Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
And I just got back from Michigan. I'm from Lansing, and I was in Lansing last week in the Detroit area. And it's such a sad story, and, you know, with so many people out of work and businesses boarded up and people losing their homes. And what in the world can help turn that around where they can actually start having jobs again and getting their lives back together?
Well, you know, Sarah, we only take difficult questions. That's just much too easy for this program.
Oh.
Only kidding. Believe me, only kidding. Would you like to tackle that, Andy? I certainly don't.
Sure. Sure. Sarah, thanks for calling in with your question. And it's a very good one. It's legitimate, and it's something that a lot of people really are wondering now. And it's not just Detroit. It's many other areas where we used to have factory and infrastructure. And really, the short answer is we need to start making more products here in America. And there seems to be, you know, something of a national pride movement that's going on, with people are becoming a little bit more self-conscious about buying things that are made here. But in so many instances, we just don't have choices. You know, you go into a Walmart or a Kmart or one of the Target, one of those places, try and find something that's made in America, it's very difficult. The short answer is we need to make more products here. The more difficult answer is, how are we going to make those products that can be priced competitively when you have people that are working in Asia for, you know, 50 cents a day? It's very difficult, you know, given the trade agreements that are in place, given, you know, our trade environment and our reliance on foreign infusions of capital to keep our economy going. It's difficult to say, hey, China, we're gonna put quotas and tariffs on all, you know, trinkets that you guys send over here. That's not going to work. You know, the same goes for a number of other nations because we depend on them so much. And this is kind of the hole that we've kind of pigeonholed ourselves into with regards to trade. We've given away so much of our national independence because we're relying on foreign oil, and that's been going on for years, and that's been hotly contested. We're dependent on that. It goes way beyond that, though. It's not just that. It's so many finished goods, capital goods, services. You know, if you go to a radiology place and have your x-ray taken, it could very well be read in India. So we've got all these different instances where those things could be done here. They should be done here. We have plenty of qualified people here that can do these jobs, but we have trade agreements, trade environment, and a financing environment that is really weighing against bringing a lot of these jobs back home in meaningful measure. So unfortunately, To get back to your question about Detroit, that's what it's going to take to make these areas flourish again and to bring them out of this depression that they're in. And unfortunately, we're so far off as far as getting the environment set up where we could cultivate a job-friendly and manufacturing-friendly environment here in America.
Andy, let me tag on something here. Is it such that we took advantage of the situation that we were in after World War II, where we were the only producing industrial economy in the world, a major economy in the world? So we were able to produce items at whatever the cost was. People had to buy them because they were unavailable anyplace else. Japan at the time was producing some stuff, but it was junk at the time. When Deming went over there and showed them how to make quality merchandise, which we ignored altogether, they started producing things that were of higher quality than they were over here. So things started to turn when we no longer had a monopoly. While we had the monopoly, our pay scale kept on rising exponentially, while the rest of the world stayed the same. So we became uncompetitive by virtue of our own success. Does that make any sense, or am I going down the wrong road?
No, you're absolutely right, and I think a lot of it comes back to the monetary system. You know, you mentioned the pay scales growing exponentially. That was happening because while we had status after World War II, what we did is we started these programs and all of this kind of thing, and we spent away the national savings account. We spent away our surpluses,
right.
And obviously, the Federal Reserve continued to devalue the dollar. You know, if you take even their own data, you take a look at it, and it shows a steady devaluation ever since they became in control of the money supply. You know, so you had that, and that drove up wages. And basically, we got so out of kilter with the rest of the world that once they figured out, in Japan, I'll use steel as an example. You know, Japan was in the ruins after World War II, but what they did is they built ultra-modern steel-producing facilities.
Right.
And our steel companies here, for the most part, didn't ever bother to modernize. So the Japanese could make it cheaper, they could make it quicker, and they took advantage of that.
Yeah,
our companies couldn't compete.
Yeah, Sarah, are you still on the line, Sarah?
Yes, I am.
Sarah, I think a partial answer may be, and I'll let Andy chime in, is that we're going to have to be prepared to start working for less. We're going to have to become price competitive as well as quality competitive and all this other stuff. And not only with our ingenuity, but with working per hour. And I think we may wind up getting into a deflationary pay scale environment until we become more competitive. For example, China is all hacked off because they have closed thousands of factories in China. It's a little known fact. Thousands of factories have closed in China because Vietnam is producing those same goods at the same or better quality at a lower price. So you see what's happening around the world, and we can't exempt ourselves from it. We can't say, well, we'll exclude ourselves from the world economy. We'll just continue to do it our way, and that's unfortunate. It's going to be I think it's going to be a real tough road, Sarah. I don't think there's an easy answer. Andy, I'll give you the last word on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, but that's a very good point that you bring up, a deflationary wage environment, because, I mean, basically you've got a couple of different ways this thing can go. We can either work for less, and that's not going to fly really because of our price environment.
Right.
So basically, all else being the same, if we were to say, all right, everybody in America is going to work for, I don't know, I'm going to pick an arbitrary number, 25% less, say.
Right.
That basically, given everything else, you're going to have a substantial decrease in the living standard here.
Right.
And that's not something people really want to hear. The other end of this thing is we could say, all right, we are just not going to, we're going to try and apply pressure on China and some of these other countries. We're going to start tariffing their goods, and we're going to start putting quotas on them, and we're going to try and attack it from that side, and we'll deal with the fallout. You know, they might say, hey, all right, we're not going to buy any more treasuries. Well, then our government's going to have to stop spending so much money.
Right.
You know, so there's a couple different ways this could be attacked at. What I try to drill down to is where does the willpower lie in not only the political structure, but in, you know, the people, the populace. And I'm not seeing a lot of focus on these kinds of issues. I see a lot of, well, we're going to blame so-and-so because they have this particular position or because, you know, the other guy didn't do this, or it's more to me, Joe, about people right now than it is about the actual issues. And as long as the issues aren't even being discussed, we're a ways off from even starting to address any of this. That's just my opinion.
No, yeah, and you know, people and understand, Sarah. We basically are a nation at war, and probably will always be at war for one reason or another, justified or not. And even a nation that is at war, as we are experiencing a recessionary environment, which is very, very unusual. As I heard one person say, says, we can save a lot of lives by making believe we going to war, building tanks, building all the bombs, building everything we need, airplanes, going out in the middle Pacific, just dropping them, make them sink to the bottom, you know, come back and produce more, and no one will die. Okay? Sarah, did we satisfy you at least, or satisfy your questions?
Yes, that was very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for calling Liberty
Talk
Radio.
Good answers.
Right. Good night. All right, we have, you want to take another call here? Here we got another caller.
Sure, go right ahead.
Call the 298. You're on the air.
This is Jim, Bixby, Oklahoma.
Jim from Bixby. How are you, Jim?
Good, good. How are you doing tonight?
Fine, fine. Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
And Andy, always enjoy your monthly calls with Joe. Glad that you're, at least for the time being, you guys are hopefully will make this a regular event.
Glad to be here.
Well, good. I happened to catch a couple minutes of CNN today. I try to avoid mainstream news, but was in the lobby of a business, and I was kind of a captive audience. And Obama happened to say, you know, he's been looking for scapegoats with the national economy, and for a while he was, you know, blaming it on Bush and the past administration, which is understandable. Today he happened to say that the one reason why our economy is so stagnant and sluggish is because CEOs are hoarding cash. And I wanted to get your reaction to that comment, and then I have a quick follow-up question.
Which CEOs?
Well, yeah, I mean, he wasn't specific. Obviously, the ones that I assume he's speaking of, the probably, you know, primarily the Fortune 500 companies that are cash rich, but beyond that, you know, I don't think he was specific in any way.
Yeah, well, I know there's a lot of anger right now about the banking system. That's why I asked which CEOs. There's all these bailout dollars from you and I, basically, and our children and grandchildren, have you. And they've essentially sat on it, and the Federal Reserve incentivizes them to do so, paying them interest on their balances that are held at the Fed. And they've actually been so bold as to say, hey, we're going to create, and I think they actually pilot tested this about a month or two ago, the Fed wants to create a bank CD program where banks can deposit monies at the Fed, and basically it's like you and I buying a CD. But that's kind of an aside. So they've been hoarding it. But I know that there's a lot of people that are kind of getting after some of the bigger companies because they are cash rich. Most of it's borrowed, by the way. Very, very little of it's actually been achieved by, you know, actual earnings increases. If you look at most of the S&P 500, a lot of that money, there's a lot of debt there, too. But anyway, they do have cash, and they are kind of sitting on it, paying a pittance, really, in interest, and they're not hiring. And I think the reason they're not hiring is because they're looking at it like we are, and they're saying, well, why should I go? Where's the incentive for me to go and expand my business right now?
Right.
Where's the spending going to come from? Where is the consumer activity or what have you? Where's the industrial activity? Or, you know, maybe it's a big outfit like a Dow Chemical or a DuPont that makes housing products or some whatever. And they're saying, well, that market's in the toilet, so where exactly is the opportunity here, and why should I go out and expand operations? I think instead of blaming people, you know, these politicians ought to tackle the issue, you know, and it comes back to that again. You know, they want to blame people and have scapegoats instead of saying, well, why are they doing this?
Right.
And there's very good reasons.
Well, I agree. I think, you know, any, you know, whether it be a Microsoft or a DuPont, I mean, there is so much, to put it bluntly, uncertainty with our economy, that to make major investments could be highly risky and speculative, and a lot of it has to do with the uncertainty of increased taxes and regulations that the Feds are doing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can tell you this much, Jim. I'm up here in the Northeast, and I have a really hard time finding anybody. And I talk to mostly small business, you know, small and medium sized people. I get emails from them. I have conversations. I have friends, whatever, and I can't find anybody that's, you know, ripping and tearing to go out and expand their operation. People are trying to figure out how to cut costs, how to squeeze more out of a nickel, and most of them are trying to figure out how to do it without laying off any more people. And that's the climate. That's the environment. So I think scapegoating them and saying, well, you know, these bosses, these company bosses, are the reason why the economy is sluggish. First of all, it's ridiculous because small business does most of the hiring in the country anyway. So to blame Fortune 500 CEOs is kind of misdirected to begin with.
Right.
So there's a lot of things wrong with a statement like that. And I think, again, it comes back to we're just looking to blame somebody, and we're really not concerned about the actual issue.
And of course, Obama would know so much about running a business, right?
Well, I wouldn't let him. You know what? I'll be honest with you. I wouldn't let him. I wouldn't have let the guy before him or the guy before that run a lemonade stand.
Exactly.
Hey, Jim,
real quickly, I'll take your answer off the air. Joe and your last caller have already. It's hard to talk about the economy without referring to the global implications. As an investor, and I'm not asking for individual investment advice, but I'm intrigued by a lot of the other global economies. Some are doing rather well, some better than others. Do you have a favorite country or region from an investment point of view? If someone, myself or anyone, was to look at like country ETFs, are you most bullish about a particular country or region? And I'll. And if you would answer that and briefly share why, I'd appreciate it, and I'll take your answer off the air. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks, Jim.
That's
a good question that he brings up, because there's a lot of people that really are looking outside America. And, you know, it's difficult because you have to look at a lot of different things when you look at countries. Obviously, you want to look at political stability. You want to look at, you know, their position in the world economy. My big keyword right now is sustainability, is what they're doing. Yeah, it might be working real good right now.
Right.
Is it sustainable?
Yeah.
Is it something that's going to last into the long run? And there's a couple places, and oddly, I'm not real bullish on China. A lot of people go crazy over China. I am not crazy over China, and there's a lot of reasons for it. The smallest of which is that obviously their GDP is running very hot.
Right.
That's really not sustainable at this point. They're even trying to step on the brakes and cool it down a little bit. I like some of the other smaller countries that service the people in China with staple goods. That's something you can look into. And there's a number of countries in Asia that do that. You can look at Singapore, you can look at Hong Kong, and you can find opportunities there. China obviously has a huge population, and looking at companies that provide them with basic necessity type goods is a real solid place to start. I like Brazil. I like Brazil because they've got a bunch of resources down there. They have some oil resources. They have the forest down there, obviously. There's a lot of good things going on down there. Their currency has been very competitive, particularly against the dollar, which I know isn't saying much, but you've got that whole situation there in Brazil. I also like Canada. Canada's set up fairly well fiscally. A lot of people kind of bashed Canada because their treatment recently of some of the royalty trusts that
right.
they have up there,
yeah.
particularly in energy.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to be sorry they did that. But as far as fiscal situations go, Canada probably is a little bit better off than some of these other places as well. So there are things out there. There are locales and jurisdictions where you can find a bunch of opportunities.